Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review for Thursday, October 12, 2017. We'll start with an article on the front page, headlined, Firehouse Proposal Sparks Questions. Some ask why station would be built in neighborhood, by Tom Lisi, Herald and Review. Decatur. City officials said they'll take into account residents' concerns as they consider a plan to move the city's northernmost fire station to a new building on Decatur's northwest side. The corner of West Mound Road and Green Ridge Drive would be the new home of Station 5, now located at 225 East Christine Drive, just north of Brentwood Village. Fire Chief Jeff Abbott said building a new fire station there would allow firefighters to arrive more quickly at emergencies on the north side of the city. We need a better way to get across to Oakland Avenue and east toward Interstate 72, where we're responsible to cover too, and this accomplishes that goal, Abbott told the Herald and Review. But the most vocal of the 30 residents who showed up to a public meeting at Mound Chapel Church of God on Wednesday expressed worries about blaring sirens, decreased access to street parking, the potential for car accidents, and an effect on adjacent property values. Several wanted to know why the location on a residential street was necessary. There will be people who may be in favor who aren't at the meeting, but nobody will walk away from here saying that the entirety of this group left and were excited about the proposal, Deputy Manager Billy Tyus said. Mayor Julie Moore Wolf and Decatur City Council members Pat McDaniel and Lisa Gregory attended the meeting, held at Mound Chapel Church, and assured residents that they would take their thoughts into consideration when making the decision, which the council ultimately must approve. The plan comes as part of a comprehensive, multi-million-dollar effort meant to address years of deferred maintenance in the city's seven fire stations, which were built between 1927 and 1994. Station 5 is one of three stations that consultants Dewberry Architects, Inc. recommended replacing, rather than renovating, in a report completed last year. Abbott said the desire to bring a fire station farther north in Decatur has existed since the 1990s, when new residential developments were built there and new land was annexed into the city, increasing the service boundaries for the city's fire department. He and Tyus told residents at the meeting that no other locations had worked out so far that would meet the fire department's specifications and goals, but declined to name specific sites they had investigated. Marie Wayne said she and her family approached the city earlier this year about her late grandmother's home on 330 West Mound Road. Wayne's late grandfather, Jack Moore, built the home in 1947, when Mound Road was a gravel road, she said. Wayne said her late grandmother, Betty Moore, continued to live there until she died in December. City Manager Tim Gleason said the city had an option to buy the land for close to $30,000, though negotiations are still ongoing. I'm concerned that it would not sell very well or eventually go to another business and make property values go down. I don't see it as a very desirable property for a family to move into because of the location, Wayne said. The house sits almost directly across the northern entrance into Target. Abbott said the planned cost to build the new Station 5 would be $2 million, part of an $8.5 million plan to renovate or replace the seven fire stations in the city. Gleason said the plan to cover the $8.5 million is already accounted for in the city's current spending levels, taking $400,000 to pay debt service annually over 20 years. Abbott said the police, fire, and city staff are taking the need for facility updates as an opportunity to improve fire response times to newly developed areas of the city to the north and southeast near the Decatur Airport. Gleason said several steps after the public meeting will need to take place before final plans are made. The city will need to purchase the land. The city council must vote to rezone the property and approve financing and design plans for the new station. The other fire stations up for possible moves are Fire Station 7 at the Decatur Airport and Fire Station 3 by Fairview Park. Abbott said Station 3 has experienced difficulty with traffic at US 36 and Fairview Drive, and the building itself is in need of major updates. At a glance, Decatur's Fire Station 5, built in 1962, now located at 225 East Christine Drive, north of Brentwood Village. Long response times to northern corners of Decatur. New site would be 330 West Mound Road. $8.5 million projected cost to city for new building. The Last Witch of Scoville. Annual event serves as a farewell to closing golf course by Claire Hettinger, Herald and Review, Decatur. Eileen Zills drove her golf cart around Scoville Golf Course through the fog and mist Wednesday morning and cackled into the cool fall air. The lace on her red and black witch hat covered her eyes, but not her smile. The course hosted the Witch Golf Tournament, and although Zills couldn't play because of an injury, she made sure others enjoyed themselves. She whipped around the course, passing out candy and heckling dozens of competitors dressed in witch hats and striped socks. The course was decorated with Halloween signs, dummies stabbed with golf clubs, and other festive decor, including a giant spider. "The guys on the grounds crew have a lot of fun putting it together," said Sandy Fisher, who helped organize the event. "It's inspired by a tournament at the former Nelson Park Golf Course called The Monster, which traditionally presented participating golfers with challenging conditions. The Monster was held on the weekend, so the Witch began for women who don't golf on the weekends," Fisher said. The decorations made the game fun, one golfer, Phyllis Kunzman, said. "The different holes with increased difficulty also make the game fun, presenting a more challenging and unique experience. I just enjoy it. All the girls dress up," Kunzman said. The event is held for women to have some fun and celebrate a good season of golfing before the course closes for the winter. This year, however, the closure is permanent. The Decatur Park District is closing the course after 88 years, citing declining revenue and interest in the sport. So it became a last hurrah for many of the women who won't be playing together much anymore. As Zills drove her golf cart broom around, she heckled the players and passed out glow-in-the-dark chocolate. She also reminisced about the Scoville course and the good memories she's had there. She paused at her favorite spot on top of a hill by the eighth hole and took in the view. "It's a good end to the year," Zills said. "Hopefully we can do it next year. I don't know, it'll have to be a different course." She also wondered what will happen to the land, something that hasn't been made clear to the public. Another golfer, Louise Mrozczyk, agreed. She said, "It's sad. It's a wonderful golf course, especially for women, because it is a shorter course. Now, the ladies who've become good friends will be all spread out," Mrozczyk said. "Some will go to Mawikwa to play, and others will go to the other locations in town, Hickory Point Golf Course and Red Tail Run Golf Club." "I think it's awful. I really do," Mrozczyk said. "If you ask everybody in here, it's the same thing. It shouldn't be closed. But what are you going to do?" Decatur Park's Learning Curve at Home in Scoville. Permanent sculpture to illuminate local artists' work. By Jalen Cook, Herald and Review, Decatur. It's appropriate that the newest addition to the Scoville Sculpture Park is called Learning Curve. As people waited for the towering structure to be unveiled to the public Wednesday evening, many quickly took notice of the prominent curve in its design. Artist Aaron McIntosh said, "Learning Curve makes sense. Not only for that reason, but also because it's the first sculpture that he's ever created." "Well, that's what it's been," said McIntosh, 39, in reference to the title. With steel fabricated by Iron Bull Fabrications and a curved LED display, McIntosh's sculpture was one of more than 200 potential pieces that the Decatur Parks Foundation considered installing in the sculpture park. Since June 2016, the foundation has overseen the park project with a $250,000 grant from the Howard G. Buffett Foundation and cooperation with the Children's Museum of Illinois, Decatur Parks District, Decatur Arts Area Council, and Newhoff Media. Jill Appleby, the foundation's executive director, said the board narrowed the selection field to 12 sculptures and chose Learning Curve as a permanent addition to the park. "We really wanted to focus on having a local artist," Appleby said. "That was important to us. After talking to Aaron and hearing his vision and seeing his thoughts, it's all just come together like a perfect plan." Originally from Champaign, McIntosh said he and his wife Abby moved to Decatur about 5 years ago. The couple owns and operates both New Era Signs, Inc. and the Standing Paddle Company, which offers kayak and stand-up paddleboard rentals on Lake Decatur. Since the couple joined the community and opened their businesses, McIntosh said his experiences in Decatur have introduced him to many new things about the city that he's come to admire. "The idea behind this piece is that it's peeling out of the ground and revealing more about our community," he said. The sculpture's LED display is designed to reflect into a pool of water at its base. On Wednesday, it displayed vivid, multicolored, constantly shifting patterns, which McIntosh credited to a screensaver by software artist Scott Draves. In the future, McIntosh said he plans to collaborate with Millikan University students and showcase their artwork on the screen. "This is just a canvas for them to work on," he said, "to be able to create whatever they want." Inspiring the creativity of young artists has become a goal for McIntosh in recent years. "When I was in high school, we had one tub of clay that had to last us for the whole year, and the football team got new helmets every year," he said. "When I can find an opportunity to share more growth in art, I'm all for that." Appleby said Learning Curve's display is powered by electricity and will only be activated during park hours. As for the other sculptures, they will only be on display for 2 years and are available for purchase from the artists, with 20% of the proceeds going to the Parks Foundation. Two of the current sculptures, one of a butterfly and the other of a dragon, which sits in front of the Children's Museum, have been purchased by donors. The others are scheduled to be replaced in summer of 2018. Appleby is looking forward to the future of the sculpture park and hopes that Learning Curve will leave visitors in awe. "It's a piece of beauty and something that people are going to come here and see," she said. "It might even become an icon in Decatur." Scoville Sculpture Park Hours. Until the end of Boo at the Zoo, October 13th through 15th, 20th through 22nd, and 26th through 29th, the sculpture park will be open from dawn to 8 p.m. Afterward, the park will operate according to the park district's park hours of dawn to 10 p.m. Millikan plans new theater dance center. $25 million project to break ground next year. By Donette Beckett, Herald and Review, Decatur. Millikan University leaders on Wednesday announced plans for the new Center for Theater and Dance, a $25 million project expected to break ground next year. The opening is planned for the fall of 2020, officials said during a news conference at the campus's Albert Taylor Theater. The new building aims to consolidate facilities for the School of Theater and Dance and accommodate a growing number of students in those programs. Performance, learning in action, is at the heart and center of all disciplines at Millikan, said University President Patrick White during the announcement. Nowhere more so than in the School of Theater and Dance. More than half of the $25 million funding for the facility has been donated by Millikan alumni, community leaders, and the College Board of Trustees, the remaining funds still need to be raised. The facility will house faculty offices, studios, classrooms, labs, and a convertible theater designed for easy changes depending on the production, officials said. Students pursuing arts technology, lighting and sound, and costume design are also expected to benefit from the new space. Mary Black, director of the School of Theater and Dance, said its enrollment has grown 42% in the past 5 years. Nearly 250 students are currently enrolled in the school's programs. As we've grown, our current facilities are no longer adequate, she said. More students could be attracted after recent positive attention toward the university's offerings. Its Bachelor of Fine Arts, BFA, in acting degree program was recognized as one of the top 10 in the country last month, according to a survey published by the theater news and review blog OnStage. The website in August 2016 also named Milliken as one of the best institutions to earn a bachelor's degree in musical theater. To sustain that success and allow room for growth, White said the new building is necessary. To keep our students and our program at this extremely high level, we need a center for theater and dance, he said. Milliken will continue to use its existing theater spaces, including the Albert Taylor Theater and Kirkland Fine Arts Center, Black said. The school's faculty members have hoped and planned for their own building for many years, she said, and are happy to have more options for students. Currently, our performance venues, acting and dance studios, classrooms and offices are spread across a dozen different buildings on Milliken's campus, and the School of Theater and Dance has continued to excel. As a junior studying theater design, Caitlin Garrity has worked in the university's existing technical studios and said she knows improving them will help students improve their craft. Fully equipped lighting, sound, and costume labs will give students access to technology they need, she said. Designers and technicians will have opportunities to work with updated and professional equipment. We are already making incredible art at Milliken, she said. If you can take all that talent and skill and allow it to grow and foster in a building fully equipped for our needs, what we can do will be extraordinary. Black said the new center will have a fully equipped theater, production spaces, costume studios, and laboratory spaces for lighting, sound, and costume construction. The facility will allow students the tools and technologies as they need to prepare them for professional success in these areas, she said. Professional actress and 1999 Milliken alumna Annie Wershing spoke to the audience via Skype. Wershing has appeared on several television shows, including 24, General Hospital, Vampire Diaries, and Castle. Remembering how she used to rush around campus, Wershing said it will be ideal to have all the classes in one building. Our classes were everywhere, she said. We were running around like crazy people. Corrections. Ryan D. Waters is one of two men charged with the murder of 22-year-old Zachary Hubbard of Windsor. Waters' middle initial was incorrect in the story White Pleads Not Guilty to Murder in the October 5th Herald and Review, as well as five previous stories. Brian Bertram provided a semi-truck of food to the WSOY Community Food Drive, surprising his grandson, Brian Bertram II. The names were transposed in the editorial, Food Drive Shows Region at Its Best, in Tuesday's Herald and Review. This week at heraldandreview.com/calendar. Friday, Boo at the Zoo, 5:30 to 8 p.m., Scoville Zoo, 217-421-7435, 375 to 475. Jack-o'-lanterns guide you through treat stations staffed by community volunteers. Carousel, train rides. Saturday, Hog Shoot Opry Harvest, 2 p.m., Calix Center for Sustainability, 436 East 1300 North Road, Monticello, $15. Music, bonfires, camping, and more. Budget changes mean less for roads. In Shelby County, loss in maintenance funds could be $200,000. By Sharon Barricklow for the Herald and Review, Shelbyville. Adding transit services funding to the Illinois Department of Transportation's budget will cause hardships for many counties and townships, Shelby County Highway Engineer Alan Spessard said Wednesday. Spessard told the Shelby County Board that the state budget plan approved by lawmakers in July, after a 2-year stalemate, moves transit funding from the general fund to IDOT's motor fuel tax-funded road maintenance plan, resulting in a $50 million cut for county and township highway funds across Illinois. "It's a terrible story," Spessard said. "And worse, if things don't change, it will happen every year." Spessard said moving transit costs to the road fund means an inequitable distribution of motor fuel tax dollars. He said that 94% of Illinois counties will get no benefit from this, either in road or transit money. For Shelby County, the loss means up to $200,000 less in county and township coffers for resurfacing and road maintenance. "It means we won't be doing much seal coating, oiling, and chipping next year," Spessard said. The losses come as no surprise to State Senator Chapin Rose, Republican of Mahomet. "This is what happens when you don't get a budget for 2 years," Rose said. "I can't even use the word budget to describe what happened in July." Rose said he had heard from several counties and townships in his district about the cuts in road funds. "Without significant change, I see more cuts happening because of Illinois' budget troubles," he said. Central Illinois Public Transit, the rural transportation system that serves Shelby County, expects no increase in revenue from the tax juggling. CIPT Director Susan Love compared the changes to a chicken and the egg situation, especially in larger counties her agency served. "We need good roads to provide good transportation," Love said. "In Shelby and Montgomery counties, for example, those are a lot of county and township roads that cover a large area. No one benefits if those roads can't be maintained." Shelby County Board Chairman Dave Cruitt said he and other board members continue to press Rose and other legislators to find funding solutions. "This has an economic effect on counties and townships," Cruitt said. "Our representatives need to know how much difference it will make so they can help us." "We've got to stop digging ourselves into a hole," Rose said. "The state is $1.5 billion in the hole, and at some point it has to stop. Taxpayers and local governments can't keep going like this." Plea deal might be back in 2015 case. Kesley Taylor was shot, killed during apartment robbery. By Tony Reed, Herald and Review, Decatur. A plea bargain for one of the men charged with the robbery and murder of a Decatur woman might be on again. The lawyer representing Shaitan L. Cook, Jr., 18, appeared in a Macon County Circuit Court pretrial hearing Wednesday and asked for more time to discuss a potential plea deal. Cook is being held in the Macon County Jail. Defense attorney Philip Tibbs told Judge Thomas E. Griffith that a previous potential deal that would have seen Cook serve 20 years was still on the table from the Macon County State's Attorney's Office. In a court hearing August 14th, Cook appeared to reject the deal and had said in court he had tried to do his own deal involving pleading to a charge of armed robbery, although "I didn't commit murder or robbery," he told the court. But without the plea deal, prosecutors had warned he could be looking at a maximum sentence of 100 years if convicted. Tibbs said Wednesday that if Cook decides to change his mind, the earlier offer is still a valid offer to my client. Griffith agreed to set the case back for another pretrial hearing November 20th. Cook has so far pleaded not guilty to the robbery and murder of Kesley Taylor, 21, on September 7th, 2015. She died from multiple gunshot wounds in her apartment, and a roommate, Brittany Wilson, was also shot multiple times but survived. There are two other 18-year-old defendants in the case facing the same charges. Daquan Klein has already pleaded guilty to a first-degree murder charge carrying a 20-year prison term and is due to be sentenced October 18th. The case of the third defendant, Darian Evans, is due to be discussed in a meeting between prosecutors, the defense, and the judge today. McMillan seeks to unseat Menar. Christian County GOP chair says he can offer fresh perspective. By Ryan Boyles, Herald and Review. Taylorville. Christian County Republican Party Chairman Seth McMillan will seek to unseat two-term State Senator Andy Menar in next year's election. McMillan made it official that he would seek the seat in the 48th Senate District Wednesday afternoon outside the Christian County Courthouse in Taylorville. During his introduction, McMillan identified himself as someone who could provide a fresh downstate perspective while accusing Menar of working for Chicago over the needs of his own district. Illinois needs a new direction from an environment of tax and spend to one of growth and reform, McMillan said. McMillan attacked Menar on several issues, including the school funding reform legislation passed by lawmakers in August. Menar spent years spearheading the new school funding formula through the General Assembly. McMillan characterized the funding reform bill as a Chicago bailout that hurt downstate schools by not giving them more dollars. Menar did not immediately respond to a request for comment Wednesday. The issue puts him at odds with Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, who has begun to run television advertisements praising the legislation as a landmark for the state. Even Representative Avery Bourne, a Republican from Springfield who introduced McMillan on Wednesday, wrote an op-ed with Menar supporting the bipartisan agreement on education funding. The differences with Rauner also includes the latter's controversial signing of House Bill 40, which allows the state to cover abortions for its employees and Medicaid recipients, as well as protect access to abortion in the state if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, the landmark decision that legalized it. McMillan said he totally disagreed with the governor's decision to sign the legislation last month, but he did not go as far as some statewide Republicans who have called for Rauner to face an in-party challenge in next spring's primary election. He said he would support whomever wins the primary. "Right now, I support the governor's re-election," McMillan said. McMillan said he would go into the State House looking for cuts to state spending to relieve the financial burden placed on residents. When asked later to identify specific programs or areas he would cut, McMillan said that he had not identified any in particular. He also said in his announcement that he would push for a new capital bill to help improve downstate infrastructure, but said afterward he would have to get into the State House before he would know how to fund what is likely to be a billion-dollar endeavor. The race could be one of the most competitive state races, Senate races, as statistics compiled by IllinoisElectionData.com, which ranks districts by how strongly Democratic or Republican they are, finds the 48th to be the most right-leaning Senate district currently held by a Democrat. Along with serving as county party chairman, McMillan owns Taylorville-based McMillan Landscape Company and previously served on the Taylorville School Board. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Herald and Review for Thursday, October 12th, 2017. Please stay tuned.